Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
We're focusing this effort in 18 states in the Southeast and then some in the plains as well. Minnesota, Iowa, on down to Texas, Missouri, Nebraska, and then those Southeastern states. And so we're looking for areas where we can build on existing populations. There's a lot of science behind this.
USDA's Robert Bonney on a new Northern Bobwhite Quail pilot program.
The NRCS scientists have worked to look for areas that we can really build on existing populations and benefit this important bird. There's lots of practices here that will have multiple benefits, improve the health of those ecosystems, allow for management for timber production or livestock production or agricultural production where we're doing quail management on the edge of fields. So there's lots of opportunity here for producers. There are going to be big benefits for wildlife, big benefits for the climate, and we hope benefits for producers as well.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
How do you manage through strategic risks that your farm is going to face? I'm going to turn it over to my colleague, Dr. Michael Langmeyer, to kind of set up what is a strategic risk.
Brady Brewer, Associate Professor, Department of Ag Economics at Purdue, at a recent Commodity Classic Session.
Essentially, what we're talking about here is the risk of being out of position. Many farms have a competitive position strategy, either to be a low-cost producer or a value-added producer or something like that, and things happen. And things like government policy changes, geopolitical conflicts, disease, change to consumer preferences, changing weather patterns, all this stuff happens. And does it cause you to lose your competitive position? Do you fall behind others in the industry that may be reacting more appropriately to changes? And so we're trying to look at the internal resources and capabilities that we have and trying to respond to external forces.
We're talking about strategic risk and positioning your farm for the long-term success. One of the things I'm a big proponent of is thinking about the strategic levers you can pull on your farm, and that's how we're going to organize the rest of this session, is thinking about what are some items that you can do within each of these strategic levers that can help you mitigate some of the strategic risks you may face. So the five levers you see up on the screen, so output price, yield, managing your costs, managing your assets, managing your people. Painting with a broad brush, so broadly speaking, any decision you make on your farm is going to fall into one of these five broad buckets. If you're choosing a new piece of equipment, that's on the asset piece, but it also covers some of the other buckets as well, thinking about how that impacts maybe your variable or fixed costs, how that's going to impact your precision or your yield that you have, maybe your labor requirements that you have on your farm. So any decision you make on your farm is going to be categorized into one of these five buckets. So now we're going to start comparing your guys' answers with maybe these five strategic levers to what the National Survey and the Ag Economy Barometer said. So this is slightly different than the five buckets you just saw. This was a slightly different version of those strategic levers where we add in legal and then we separate people into kind of the strategic arm of your farm, and then there's also the human side. So the question we want to ask is, which of the following risks would you say is most threatening to your organization? It looks like the majority of this audience, at least, is thinking that the financial risk of the farm is the biggest threat. Is this surprising to you?
Not at all. When you look at the 24 crop budgets, for example, I mean, it's a classic margin squeeze. The prices are lower and the costs are still relatively elevated. We've got a little bit of help from fertilizer costs, but cost of production are still very high, particularly compared to production costs before COVID.
And then the second bucket there is marketing. I think given some of the current commodity prices and the decrease in commodity prices, that's not surprising as well.
My name is Jim Mintert. I'm the director of the Purdue Center for Commercial Agriculture and also a professor of ag economics.
So it's not surprising, but one of the things that has been surprising on our surveys over the last 2 years, really, is the percentage of people who have been very worried about input cost, not just from a level standpoint, but from a standpoint of the variability that they've experienced with respect to those input prices. And it's really made people very nervous, I think, and actually contributed to people having some relatively weak sentiment. So, but marketing, a very traditional concern, and in our most recent surveys, we've been picking that up as people becoming more worried about marketing, which is kind of a return to normality.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
The company introducing this new brand identity and ad campaign that's really kind of aimed at bringing meat eaters and flexitarians into the fold in a bigger way.
CNBC's Kate Rogers interviewing CEO of Impossible Foods, Peter McGinnis, on Thursday.
Why are you going this route?
Well, I mean, that the addressable market's huge, Kate, right? You're talking, you know, close to $1.4 trillion globally, right? Total animal products, chicken, beef, pork globally. So the addressable market's huge. And I think that the product was always designed to appeal to meat eaters. This is a meat alternative product. Taste, texture, flavor, the way it sizzles, the way it cooks. And also, when you look at the health benefits, zero cholesterol, 50% less saturated fat, excellent source protein, it brings good health benefits to people. The animal welfare side, you're not killing animals. And then, of course, the planet welfare side, you're avoiding GHG, you're using less water, land, removing less trees. So in totality, from an addressable market perspective, it makes sense to kind of go after, for lack of a better term, or, you know, invite meat eaters to try the product. And then also from a mission perspective, it makes sense.
Mm-hmm. And as Tyler mentioned earlier, one of your biggest competitors, Beyond Meat, also just launched a new ad campaign in recent weeks based on health messaging. It seems to me, in watching the category, it's kind of undergoing a reset right now. Why is this needed at this moment?
Yeah, listen, I think there's a lot of things that are misconstrued around the nutritional aspects of plant-based meat. And there's been a lot of things thrown out, faux, fake, processed. And some of those have stuck. But all of those have caused consumer confusion. So I think it is time to kind of set the record straight. I don't think it's about rhetoric. I don't think it's about, you know, death to the cattle industry or animal agriculture will be dead. None of that makes sense. This is about inviting meat eaters to try our product, not insulting meat eaters. And we stand behind our product. It's delicious and it's nutritious. And so that's first and foremost. Now, if you happen to be worried about animal welfare and planet welfare, that's also great too. But first and foremost, we are a food company making delicious and nutritious food that we want you to try. We think it's great. And we've been innovating. We have a whole chicken portfolio. Mm-hmm. We have beef products. We have indulgent beef, which is even thicker, juicier, meatier. So we have a lot of things for people to try. And we think they stand up really great against animal meat. In fact, people prefer our chicken nuggets and tenders and patties to animal chicken tenders.
And you also have quite a few restaurant menu offerings at places like Burger King, Starbucks. I'm curious if you can tell our viewers how your restaurant offerings are performing. Do you see more customer resistance there or in retail channels? Which is bringing more success at the moment?
Well, we see less and less, you know, resistance, actually. And we're really proud of our food service. And that's just a few of them, by the way. And we have a lot of independent restaurants, too, that perform really well and that are great that were on the menu. You know, we have over 45,000 food service locations, but there's, you know, 1.4 million food service locations. So, mm-hmm. a lot of people talk about the death of the category or, you know, it hasn't even started yet. We are in first gear. And so we're number one in food service with 45,000 locations, but there's 1.4 million. So there's a lot mm-hmm. more to go. But, you know, we love our performance at Burger King. In fact, we're testing new things with Burger King right now. We love our performance at Starbucks, as do they. So food service is a great vehicle for both the brand and also volume. But retail, we're up 10% year to date. We're the only one growing in the entire plant-based meat category. So we're growing in units, we're growing in dollar sales, and we're growing in
Certainly.
Market share. Same thing on retail. Right. We have probably, you know, 800 TDPs out of 8,000 total distribution points. So we have so much more to go.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
There's several studies out there and herds we deal with. It kind of shows the same thing, is that we see a higher incidence in male calves.
Talking BRD, or bovine respiratory disease, Dr. Greg Hanselcheck is a Kansas State veterinarian.
And that's true in other species. It looks like other species of males are more predisposed to respiratory disease. Calves from two-year-old dams, they seem to be at a higher risk. And that kind of makes sense because the two-year-olds, the heifers, their colostrum quality is not going to be as good as a cow. They may lack the mothering ability, or they may go through a dystocia. We know that calves that experience dystocia, their immune systems aren't going to function as well. Other risk factors are larger herds. And then, like I said, we know that that's true for probably all our diseases. One of the big risk factors are herds that bring in calves from outside sources. So we're talking about herds that bring in calves that may have a different strain of these pathogens or maybe a high load of these pathogens. Those herds are at a much higher risk of this disease than others. We've mentioned estrus synchronization. And then other thing is herds that experience a diarrhea problem in neonatal calves, they're typically going to be at a higher risk of having respiratory disease later on. And that could have to do with management. It could have to do with immune system and all kinds of things. So those are what we think are the major risk factors for this disease in herds.
So how can you determine the virus and what do you do?
Well, it's a great question. We get it all the time. It's the same organism in post as in post-weaning BRD. It's a Mannheimia, the Pasteurella, or the bacteria. Of the viruses, we typically see BRSV and now corona. For us, corona is the primary virus that we isolate out of these outbreaks. And I know producers know that corona is a major player in neonatal scours. This is a different corona genetically. And there's controversy out there. Is this corona actually a pathogen for respiratory disease or not? In the diagnostic lab at K-State, we believe it is. We have to know what those organisms are first before we can design any type of program. Well, if they have it in their own herd, the first thing they need to do is find out what the predominant organisms are. So if they're unfortunate enough to have any deads, then for sure have them necropsied, have some diagnostics completed on them. But there's some really good tests that can be completed on live calves by taking nasal swabs and just seeing if what bacteria, what viruses actually are there in the upper respiratory tract. And then from there, as always, they need to follow their veterinarian's advice on what treatment and what prevention program to be on. If they're not vaccinating for whatever predominant organism they find in their outbreak, then it's not going to help them this year. But for next year, they probably should add that to their vaccine program. And then the other thing is timing. Sometimes we need to time our vaccination in the calves to better match when we expect the outbreak. And some herds have changed that to maybe later on in the pasture season. That's when they vaccinate, and that seems to help. Some of the most successful things that we've seen in herds that have actually prevented this is instead of estrus synchronization, bringing everybody in the same pen, or even processing, bringing everybody in the same pen, they'll work them in small groups. And so it reduces the concentration of the organisms the calves are exposed to, and that seems to help a lot. The vaccination thing is really frustrating. There is no corona vaccine for respiratory disease, and so producers are trying to use the scour vaccine to help prevent the respiratory corona. Some are going to autogenous vaccines. Those things are just hit and miss, but those management things seem to help a bunch if we're talking about synchronization and processing.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
So here we're just going to ask you, do you have a strong balance sheet for your farm?
Brady Brewer, Associate Professor, Department of Ag Economics at Purdue, in a recent Commodity Classic session.
So it looks like right now the strongly agree, most of the people in the room feel that they have a strong balance sheet. With slightly more just saying agree rather than strongly agree. And I'm going to take this one first, and then I'll let Jim and Michael comment on this. This doesn't surprise me at all that this is how you guys feel. If you think about one of my main extension appointments at Purdue University is working with the agriculture lenders in Indiana and the surrounding states. And what I've heard from them when I go talk to them is farmers have some working capital, and the equity portion of the balance sheets is pretty strong in agriculture right now. The one comment I'm going to have there is if you think about the word cloud that we put up, right? People are worried about commodity prices. People are worried about the margins that are going to be had here for the 2024 crop season. Thinking about what I call burn rate. So if we expect negative margins or if we expect a downturn in an economy, burn rate is thinking about what's your runway? How long can you last at this lowered rate? I think building up what I'm going to call the war chest or the cushion, right, in on your balance sheet to say, okay, if 2024, if the worst case scenario in 2024 comes to fruition, how long can I last if that goes through 2024, 2025? I think that's a really important exercise when looking into strategic risk. how can your balance sheet be a buffer for this downturn? That's one thing, especially when I hear talk to the bankers and I hear with the interest rate argument that some farmers may go to working capital rather than take out a larger loan maybe on the operating side. I think keeping that war chest as full as possible for maybe a prolonged down period in commodity prices, and just know that's not what I'm predicting. I'm just saying if that were to happen, I think that is a good move on the balance sheet to kind of combat some of the strategic risk.
Dr. Jim Mentert is the director of the Center for Commercial Ag at Purdue.
If you think about it, it's no big surprise that most of us are coming into 2024 with both a strong balance sheet and a strong working capital position. That's the good news. The bad news is the next couple of years look like both of those are likely to erode, especially the working capital. So the challenge is to make sure you're managing that in a way that you can, in fact, use it, as Brady just said, to kind of weather the storm, because it looks like we're going to have a tough year from a cost return standpoint in 24. 25 might turn out to be a little better than what it looks like right now for 24, but it's probably not going to be a return to what we experienced in 22 or even 23. So the challenge is to manage that and use that for what it's for, which is a buffer.
Dr. Michael Langemeyer is a professor of Ag Economics at Purdue.
We purposely didn't define strong balance sheet before we had you answer this. And so let's talk a little bit about that. What we had in mind there was a strong current ratio, so certainly liquidity, but also solvency, low debt to asset ratio, and so on to say that. But another point I want to make here, yes, we need liquidity to weather the storm. That's what every business needs liquidity for. But you also need liquidity to take advantage of opportunities. I want to go back to that upside, upside of strategic risk. If all of this stuff's going on and you're in position and other firms are not in position to expand, to take advantage of maybe an opportunity to grow a specialty crop, that's a very good thing. And so think of liquidity as both weathering the storm and being able to respond quickly to a new opportunity.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
Every year this week, we have what we title National Agriculture Day.
And that day, March 19th, National Ag Day, Iowa Senator Chuck Grassley.
Iowa's 86,000 families work hard each day to produce the food, fiber, and fuel for the rest of America. You all know that farmers make up less than 2% of our population, yet through their hard work, they provide for the other 98%. I will continue to work each day so farmers of all sizes have a seat at the table when it comes to the farm bill and other important bills that impact our farmers. One example of a bill I'm going to introduce this week is called the Next Generation Fuels Act. The bill was in last session and didn't get passed. The Next Generation Fuel Act would establish a minimum research octane number. It would be 98 for gasoline, which is much higher than the typical octane of 91. It also requires the added octane value to reduce carbon emissions by at least 40% compared to regular gasoline. This means higher blends of ethanol will be required. We know Americans will continue to rely on gasoline and the internal combustion engine for decades to come, regardless of this administration's push for electric vehicles. My bipartisan bill will allow consumers to continue to use the cars they now drive and do it in a way that has lower carbon and lower cost fuel. And it will also expand the ethanol market for America's biofuel producers. Iowa's number one in ethanol production, and 43,000 jobs are at stake. It's going to enhance that industry tremendously.
So why is it important to set aside a national day for agriculture?
It's when we go to the supermarket, we can buy almost anything we want. And when we sit down, we don't have to have, worry about having food at the table. And we have government programs that fill in for those that maybe don't have the money to buy what they need for an adequate diet. And all this comes from the farms of America. And it's something that has two aspects, as far as I'm concerned, that are very important and not talk about. One is food is national security issue as much as it is a food security issue, because you got to be able to feed your military if you're in battle. And secondly, there's an old saying that we're 9 meals away from a revolution. In other words, if you couldn't feed your family for 3 full days and didn't know where you're going to get it on the fourth day, you'd take almost any action you could take, including maybe rioting to get the food, because we have rioting in other countries, particularly where rice is short or rice is very high expenditure. So it proves that if you want to have a social cohesion and peaceful society, the abundance of food is very important.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
As many of you know, the primary focus of AFPC has been to analyze the likely consequences of policy changes at the farm level with our one-of-a-kind data set of information that we collect from commercial farmers and ranchers located across the United States.
Hard to believe we've been trying to get a new farm bill now for over 2 years. Dr. Joe Outlaw with Texas A&M.
Working closely with 675 commercial producers has provided our group with a unique perspective on agricultural policy. Currently, we maintain the information to describe and simulate 94 representative crop and livestock operations in 30 states. In order to provide perspective on Titles 1 and 11, I wanted to briefly summarize a recent report that looks at farm profitability in 2021 relative to 2022 relative to 21 for our 64 representative crop farms in the face of higher input and output prices. For this report, we asked our panel members to provide their cost per acre for each of those years. While some producers were able to benefit by locking in input prices early in 2021 for this year's crop, most indicated very little ability to do so. The news is full of stories about inflation that is averaging 8.5% so far this year for the average American. The lowest year-over-year inflation farmers are seeing is twice that on seed, with most commodity categories many times higher. The following are highlights of the analysis that are relevant for today's hearing. Net cash farm income in 2021 included a significant amount of ad hoc assistance. Absent another infusion in 2022, we estimate that significant increases in input prices will result in a decline in net cash farm income in 2022 relative to 21. However, despite the income reduction from 21, most crops will likely still result in positive net cash farm income for the representative crop farms. The noticeable outlier is rice. Two-thirds of rice farms are facing losses in 2022. Having worked with farmers over the last 30 years, I want to make sure you understand we are talking about historic amounts of capital that farmers are putting at risk. Throughout my career, I have referred to the programs in Title I and Title XI as the three-legged stool that serves as a safety net for U.S. producers. Agriculture Risk Coverage, ARC, and Price Loss Coverage, PLC, and the Non-Recourse Commodity Loan Program serve as two of the legs, while the Federal Crop Insurance Program serves as the third leg. Price Loss Coverage was established in the 2014 Farm Bill using the cost of production as a basis for setting a level of protection for each covered commodity through reference prices. PLC rates worked fine while inflation was fairly low. However, the reference prices are in dire need of increases to remain relevant. Producers' costs have increased substantially, and the current reference prices are not providing a relevant amount of protection. Agriculture Risk Coverage was also established in the 2014 Farm Bill. ARC uses a 5-year moving average of historic prices and yields to establish a benchmark that is used to determine the level of protection producers receive. While good when coming off of relatively high prices, ARC proved worthless when prices declined and remained relatively flat. Since ARC has a reference price embedded in the calculations, raising reference prices will make ARC attractive as a revenue protection safety net alternative. Assuming these two alternatives are used going forward, instead of forcing producers to pick the tool, ARC or PLC, they want, I would suggest allowing them to receive the benefits of whichever is higher in a given year. This would cost nothing more than if producers have chosen wisely. Historically high input costs have also highlighted the shortcomings of basing safety nets on prices and or gross incomes alone. This may present an opportunity to explore adding margin coverage. However, I would urge you to proceed with caution. Dairy offers an instructive example. Dairy margin coverage was added in the 2014 Farm Bill, but the initial version was a flop that has taken years and a lot of money to improve. I believe the upcoming Farm Bill provides an opportunity to help address some of the shortcomings that ad hoc assistance was designed to address.
Testimony from 2022. It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
Finally, finalization of what the product of USA voluntary label claim means to consumers when looking at meat, poultry, and egg products at their store or retailer.
We are now on record as being for the utilization of that label only when the animal is born, raised, slaughtered, and processed in the U.S.
Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack with the announcement Monday at the National Farmers Union Convention in Arizona. He says the rule now finalized came about as a result of consumer input.
We asked him the question, when you see this label, what do you think it means? It means that everything was done in the United States. Well, actually, that's not been the case. Then we asked the question, do you place a value on that? Are you willing to pay a nickel or two more if that is on the list? Well, absolutely. We want to help our farmers. So in order for that value proposition to be respected, in order for there to be fairness and honesty and proper representation in the marketplace, it's important to have rules like this.
I'm Rod Bain reporting in Washington, D.C.